We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Hey, Tommy, I finally got to drive the new Land Cruiser.
What do you mean?
You know, the new real Land Cruiser.
So you're saying the 300 series that we don't get in the U.S. How did you drive it?
Well, I was at this Rocky Mountain Automotive Press Gala. Well, it wasn't the gala. It was a chance to drive a whole bunch of different cars. And one of the cars was the LX 700H.
Oh, yeah. So the Lexus version of the Land Cruiser. So you kind of drove a new Land Cruiser.
Yeah, no, I drove the new Land Cruiser because I think that in the rest of the world, the Land Cruiser that we get here, the 250, is the Prado.
Sure.
And the Land Cruiser that we get here, the real Land Cruiser, the Land Cruiser the rest of the world gets here would be the LX 700H.
Sure, that's exactly right. And what did you think?
Oh, God, I fell in love with that thing. I mean, it is such a... Okay, first of all, I'm going to say something, and I know this sounds wrong and awkward, but I think it's a bargain.
It is not a bargain.
It's $120,000, but I think it's a bargain. And I know that sounds absolutely wrong, but hear me out. Compared to similar vehicles that do the same thing that does, which is transport you in absolute luxury across any part of the world, like the Range Rover, it's a bargain because a Range Rover would be $170,000, maybe $50,000 more.
But do you have any intention to drive to Zimbabwe?
I don't. But, you know, people buy cars because they think they do.
So that's the problem with this has always been my problem with these newer Land Cruisers is they are very expensive.
Very expensive.
And what you're paying for is largely the brand, but also a very high level of build quality engineering, right?
Exactly.
So you're paying for that.
Redundancy,
yeah. This is a hybrid, but it also has a starter motor, right, which is pretty cool. And I think it also, even though it's a hybrid, it also has an alternator as a backup, which is very cool. But you're not going to need that. Because you, like most Land Cruiser owners, would probably keep this vehicle a few years. You drive it around on streets, maybe the occasional trail. But you're not going to need that incredible, overbuilt kind of ethos of the Land Cruiser by taking it, you know, down the road.
But let's talk about everything you get. Because, you know, in the Land Cruiser world, here in America at least, you've got kind of below the Land Cruiser, I'm talking about Toyota now, you've got the 4Runner. And then that kind of bleeds into price-wise the Land Cruiser.
The little one.
Yeah, the 250.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of bleeds into the Lexus GX.
Yes.
Right, price-wise. Sure. Yeah. And then the GX kind of doesn't really bleed into because I think the off-roady one is like $85,000. But eventually on top of that sits the LX 700. But I was looking at everything you get. First of all, you get 3 rows.
Uh-huh.
And power everything. I mean, power everything.
Sure.
You get air suspension.
You don't get air suspension.
This one had air suspension.
Does not have air suspension.
What is it?
It's hydraulic suspension.
Okay, so you get even better.
Yeah.
You get hydraulic suspension. You get heated and cooled seats. You get heated steering wheel. You get about every – mine had – the one I test drove had this beautiful ox blood red interior,
mm-hmm.
a deep, deep red, just absolutely gorgeous. Leather was supple like you wouldn't believe. Controls were actually straightforward. So they had – the car has real buttons and real controls so you don't have to put everything in the touchscreen. And, you know, like 15 different on-road and off-road modes. And then the only thing that was a little disappointing was it's got the twin turbo V6 as opposed to the old V8.
I'm going to be honest, and this is going to be a hot take here.
All right, let's hear it.
And a lot of people are going to dislike me for this, but since the 100 series debuted back in the late 90s,
mm-hmm.
I've been a little bit of a Land Cruiser hater.
Really? Okay.
I have.
Pray tell why.
Because I feel like you are paying for the fifth owner's ownership experience. And I do think it's incredible.
I understand that.
I do think it's incredible that they engineered the Land Cruiser to meet 250,000 miles, right?
And built in a separate facility.
Yeah, versus 150,000 miles for typical products. I think that is incredible. And I really appreciate that. But I just can't see paying that much money for a used vehicle and then having that not owning it for 250,000 miles or 300,000 miles. And there are people out there that do and will. And I think that's very cool. But I just think that people realistically get bored, especially enthusiasts. Look at yourself in the mirror and tell me you're going to own that car for 25 years and 200,000 miles.
I completely understand where you're coming from, Tommy. But there's like we have a friend, Eric, who bought a 100 series with 300,000 miles on it.
And as a fifth owner, they're great.
For like, I want to say he bought it for less than 10K.
Which is awesome. I think at that point it's good. But when it comes to the newer stuff, paying $120,000 for this, you are paying for that fifth owner's ownership experience. You're paying for Eric to have a great car 25 years down the road, right?
But I'm getting to the age where you can't take it with you. And so paying for that, you know, fifth owner is not that important to me.
What so
is
buy a Land Rover.
What is important to me is maybe getting a car that doesn't smell like wet dog. You know, having that new car smell, being the one that kind of gets to break that in, having the joy of picking up a new car at the dealership, it's that experience. Is that worth $120,000? I'm not sure, but it's certainly worth something.
But the problem is, Dad, you can get that same experience with a GX, and I would argue have a better vehicle.
I did not like the GX as much as I liked the 700.
Why? It's still big. It's still incredibly comfortable. It still has leather everywhere. It looks better.
One sentence. Go big or go home.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like if you're going to go there, go for the top of the line dog, you know, and don't go for the medium dog. Go for the big dog.
What's the engine in the Land Cruiser?
It's the V6 twin turbo.
What's the engine in the GX?
I don't care about that. I say when I started this? I said the only thing that I was kind of disappointed about was I like the interior better in the LX. I like the fact that, you know, it has every whistle and bell imaginable. I also like the fact that it's got this giant spindle grill, and that's a hot take because a lot of people don't like the spindle grill, right? It's almost too much. And I like the fact that, you know, you could take this vehicle and kind of luxurify it and make it off-roady because, you know, from the factory, it doesn't have the AT tires.
It does.
Yeah,
the Overtrail does. They're pretty good.
Alex, I didn't drive the Overtrail. I drove the F-Sport.
Oh, you didn't the Overtrail.
I had the F-Sport.
That F-Sport was my least favorite car I drove last year.
Really?
That car is the most confused car.
Okay.
Because the Land Cruiser, which it's based on, is known for its ruggedness.
Yes.
And then Lexus goes ahead and they make it a street-oriented version, right, on 20-inch wheels. And what you end up with is a vehicle that doesn't do the rugged thing very well because it has 23-inch wheels. And
right, that's what I said. I didn't know there was an off-roady one.
It doesn't do the street thing very well.
That's even better. Now that you've told me there's one that's specifically for off-road.
You know this. This is James' dream car.
I didn't know. I did not know. I did not go on the program.
We had it at the office.
I wasn't here.
You weren't here?
I wasn't here. I did not know.
That's the off-road one.
I didn't know there was even an off-road one. I just thought they were all like...
No,
the Alexis.
You want to look up the LX Overtrail, Cole? I think that's it right there, the white one.
Oh, look at that. See, now I want even more. You have opened my eyes up.
I thought we were talking about that. Dad, that F-Sport LX was one of the worst cars I drove because it's supposed to be sporty, but it's not sporty because it weighs 6,000 pounds.
I didn't care about it being sporty. That was not the road I was going down.
But it's
down.
Not comfortable either.
It was very comfortable.
It's got 23-inch wheels and tires that are this small.
The ride was very
plush. I disagree. I thought that the ride was not very good on the
F-Sport. Did yours have the magnetic suspension?
Yes, because we had it at the office too.
I wasn't here.
But we had them two times. You were gone both times? How could this happen?
I was not here when we had that car. I'm sorry. I've been traveling so much.
With a red interior?
Yes.
Yeah, we had it here at the office.
I wasn't here, dude.
Yeah. Listen, I think that the LX, does not float my boat. Now, the Overtrail is even cooler because the Overtrail gets you hydraulic suspension, smaller wheels, it gets you off-road tires, and it also gets you a front-locking diff. Did you know that?
Yeah, triple lock.
You get a triple, but not your F-Sport.
Yeah, I was missing that.
Only the Overtrail, I think, is triple locked.
Oh, dude, I want one so badly now.
But what are you going to do with it?
I'm not going to buy it because, first of all, it's $120,000.
But even if you did, okay?
If I did, I would take it off-road.
I don't think you would.
I would.
It's $120,000.
Let me ask you a question.
What?
Did I just take a G-Wagon off-road? $170,000?
But it wasn't your G-Wagon.
If it was mine, you think I would take it off-road? Of course. Is there any vehicle that we have purchased, no matter the price, that the company has owned, in essence, my company, that we have not taken off-road?
So when you had that Range Rover, we put it on ATs,
yeah,
and you were very hesitant to take it off-road.
But did I take it off-road?
Very rarely.
No, I was hesitant because it was a long wheelbase version.
And you said it's too nice.
No, I said it was a long wheelbase.
It was.
And the breakover was crappy.
But
and
you were also telling me it was a really nice interior. You felt bad getting it dirty, which is the same problem with the Overtrail.
No. That one, my issue, I don't want to argue. My issue with that one literally was that it was the long wheelbase, and I felt like if you're going to take one off-road, don't take the one that has a crappy breakover. But I did take it off-road. There are videos of us taking it off. Did we take the Hummer EV, $120,000?
Yes,
vehicle?
We did. Yeah. My problem with this, so I have taken this off-road.
Did we take the Ranger Raptor off-road?
Yeah, because it's built to go off-road.
So is this, $120,000 as well.
This is two Ranger Raptors from a price standpoint.
No, R.
Our, yeah. This Lexus.
No, the Ranger Raptor R is the same as this.
There's no Ranger Raptor R.
No, I'm sorry, not the Ranger Raptor. The Raptor
R. F-150 Raptor R. Yeah, it's the same price as this. We did take that off-road. But I guarantee you would never take this off-road. Because I know you.
Tommy.
I know you.
That is so insulting to tell me something I wouldn't do. I would take it off-road.
Of course,
I would.
And I remember the Range Rover, you're making that excuse about the long wheelbase. It had plenty of ground clearance.
Did I take it off-road?
Yes. But you didn't like it because you said it was too nice to take off-road.
Please, let's not bicker.
My point is, if I bought this car, I would tell myself I would take this off-road, and it would never once touch
it. Well, that's you. I would take it off-road.
Because it's just too expensive.
No, because I want to know the capability of the thing.
And other problem, it's too big.
And life is too short not to know the capability of the car. I'm sure that there are people in the Saudi Arabia world where they buy these things and just take...
They 100% do.
And I would also be one of those people.
They also don't have trees in Saudi Arabia.
That's fine. We go to Moab. There's not a lot of trees in Moab.
So Tommy. I did take this thing off-road.
Okay, how was it?
Okay, not great.
Okay, tell me why.
The problem is it has the things you need. Okay. First of all, the fact that Toyota or Lexus debuted a vehicle with the front locker is incredible. Because the number of people that work for Toyota that tell me it would never happen is truly unbelievable.
Yeah.
So congratulations to Lexus. But the problem with this vehicle is the same problem with the 200 series.
Which is?
It's just too big and heavy.
Yeah.
You get off-road in these things. Look up TFL off-road Lexus GX, Cole.
Is that it right there?
No, I did some pretty cool stuff with it. We took it to the... off-road park, actually. Oh, sorry, LX. The names are very confusing. I understand your confusion. Scroll down a little. There it is. There's Case and I. So I took it to this off-road park, and we had plenty of space. But there's just so much size and mass when you get these vehicles off-road.
This is true. When we had the 200 series off-road, I did not like it off-road.
And this is the same thing.
But we did take it up the Ironclads, which is probably the worst trail to take that up because that is a very tight trail.
Yeah, but that's the reality of Colorado off-roading, is that we just have a lot of trees and it's a lot of tight trails. And when you're dealing with a vehicle of this size, it's really hard to pick line placement. And I'm not just picking on the LX. I feel the same way about the Tahoe Z71.
Well, that new truck we bought then is going to be trouble because
it's
going
to be big
that
trouble.
Is a lot bigger than this.
So I feel the
new
same way.
Decommissioned military truck.
I feel the same way about the Tahoe and the Wagoneer and the Grand Wagoneer. Like a lot of these vehicles have the chops, but there's just so much mass when you get them off road.
You know, I didn't mind the G-Wagon off road,
but that's a little smaller.
I felt that was fine.
The dimensions of that.
I also
more
took
compact.
The G-Wagon squared off road, which is bigger.
But that's taller.
Yeah, but it is bigger, and I actually didn't feel like that was a problem taking
it off-road. The other issue with this is it's still got a lot of plastic around it.
Yeah, I see those.
So side steps, the front end is all plastic.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So it's an incredible platform. I mean, kudos. I think that the engineering behind it is amazing, and I don't want to discount that. I want to make that very clear. I think the platform is amazing, but I think realistically, as a new $120,000 vehicle with all that plastic on the front end, it's going to be pretty hard.
Well, look, I'm not going to be using it as a daily off-roader. I would take it off-road. And I would play with it off-road, and then 90% of the time, or 95%
sure,
of the time,
which is great.
It would live on-road. But I would know that it has the ability, if I needed to or if I wanted to go off-road with a vehicle that is luxurious and triple-locked.
But my thing is, yeah? I think, from my standpoint, from the time I spent off-roading the GX, as a whole, it's just a better all-around vehicle. The GX is slightly smaller. It feels a lot lighter on the trail.
I didn't love the GX, Tommy. I mean, the only one that I think had a ride that was approaching what Lexus is the is it the Overland?
Overtrail.
Overtrail, yeah. Yeah. The Overtrail
one. But that's what I'm talking about. I would get the GX Overtrail.
So I you know, the regular non-Overtrail GX, that ride was rough. I mean,
it was rough, for sure.
Whereas this LX700H F-Sport, the ride was not rough, even though I was on, you know, rubber bands for tires and very big, you know, 23s, I think you said the F-Sport has. The ride
22s was, or something. 22s. They're really big.
But anyway, the ride was supple. Whereas in the GX, without going to the Overtrail, the ride was not good.
100%, yeah. But if you get the Overtrail, the ride is very good. Mm. It's maybe not LX good. And I think that my issue with the 100 series and newer is it's the same issue I have with all the full-size stuff. It's just too much mass. It's just too much size for regular Colorado trail use.
So in terms of its competitive set, right, what would you get? Would you get the Range Rover?
Because
that's what competes against it. Now, you can't be like, oh, I spend less money and get the Bronco Raptor or some crap.
No. So if I am...
In the Escalade, that competes with it. That's 120.
If I'm looking in this category, right?
Three-row luxury SUV.
I would not take any of them off-road.
Navigator?
No. I wouldn't take any of them off-road. Mm. And if you look at them as on-road vehicles exclusively, right? If you look at them as what really they're going to be used for, on-road vehicles, I do feel like Escalade is better on the road, right? I do feel
it's
like
even bigger.
Yeah, but I don't care. On road, I don't care. If you're using it as an on road vehicle, I don't care. And if you look at it from an on road standpoint,
hard to park.
Yeah, but Escalade, you get V8. Escalade V, you get supercharged V8, right? Which is better. It's just
you don't get a triple locker.
But once again, I'm not taking this vehicle off road.
And you don't get the. I don't know about reliability, but I'm guessing a 100,000 mile Escalade is going to be, you know, half of its life is going to be gone. Whereas 100,000 mile LX700H, you're just looking at maybe, you know, the first quarter of its life. And so you're saying, you know, you're going to buy this thing for the fifth owner down the road, but maybe you'll find that you love that thing so much that you'll keep it and hold on to it. Because you're a young man, right? You can hold on to that thing for 30 years.
But I also know you and I go through cars about every 27 minutes.
That's our job.
But even if it wasn't, I think that me and you are still the kind of people that like to experience a bunch of different cars.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But like when we first started this, that first Raptor, we held on to what, 4 years?
50,000 miles. Okay, let's say you keep this car 4 years, 50,000 miles. Hmm. Any new car will last 4 years or 50,000 miles. Any new car will last 4 years or 50,000 miles. We're at the point now with across any brand, we have the ability to engineer cars.
I also think that unlike any new car, this thing won't depreciate as fast.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Yeah. You will definitely hold your value on these LXs, 100%, more than any other competition.
Because the people who know that it's the real Land Cruiser.
Sure.
And not the 250, which I'm not saying it's not a real Toyota can call whatever they want a Land Cruiser. But I think in the community,
sure,
this will always be the Land Cruiser.
I don't want to knock your dream car. I understand what you like.
I'm not saying it's my dream car. I just said I liked it a lot and thought to myself, if I had $120,000 that I wanted to spend on a car out of the competitive set, that's the one I would buy.
Range Rover's pretty darn good.
It's more.
They start at like $120,000 for the full-size Range Rover.
This has all the bells and whistles.
Yeah,
and Range Rover is not going to be triple locked.
So if I'm looking for a full-size vehicle, I would probably get the Escalade.
Yeah.
If I'm looking for...
I love the Escalade. It's just, Tommy, when I said, you said you don't care, but that thing is big. I mean, that is like, I was just driving, I just got my hair cut and I was coming back from the barbershop and there was a guy in a F-150 towing a little trailer on this little side road and I was in the Mach-E Rally and I barely squeezed by him. And imagine if you were in an Escalade.
Look up a 2025 Escalade length, Cole. I'm curious what the length difference is.
Oh, it's got to be huge because there's like literally 3 inches behind the third row in the Land Cruiser when you put the third row seats up. And I know the Escalade has a lot more.
Okay, 211 inches is the Escalade. Now look up 2025 Lexus LX length.
Hope we don't get the AI returns because those are always hard to figure out.
Lexus LX length. Yeah, so 221, 200. So 11 inches longer on the Cadillac.
A foot longer.
Yeah, a foot longer.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if I'm just using it on the road, it doesn't really matter to me because we've got big roads here. And if I'm using it off-road, I'm going to get the GX. I just think the GX is smaller, nimbler.
Well, let me keep going. I don't want to beat a dead horse. So I drove 5 cars. Mm-hmm. One I didn't drive it that you drove, so I'm curious about that, and that is the McLaren Artura. But before we get to that, I also drove 2 cars, and they brought up 2 important questions for me. So I drove the Sorento X-Pro, which is the off-roady one.
Yeah.
And I drove the Passport Trail Sport, which is the off-roady one.
Yeah.
So both compete against each other.
Sure.
Right? They're both around $50,000. And they are both like off-roadified family haulers.
Sort of.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, okay, various amounts of off-roading.
Sure. Yeah.
So the Honda's more.
Yeah.
The problem with the Sorento, it's basically got just, you know, off-road tires, ATs, and the X-Pro logo. I don't know if there's anything else. And I was thinking to myself, why doesn't Kia or Hyundai, I guess, or Honda actually build a serious off-roader with the low range? We know that Honda has the chops because in their motorsports divisions, they build incredible dirt bikes, really good side-by-sides. And then here's the other thing. The very first generation, you remember this, of Sorento? It had a low range.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It was actually more off-roady than the current X-Pro. So why don't both of these companies actually build something that will take on the 4Runner, as opposed to just building these kind of semi, you know, off-roady looking? I mean, look, they are off-roady. Honda's even probably better than the Sorento because the Passport Trail Sport does have different off-road modes, right? It has sand, it has snow, it has mud, I think, in there and in the system. But at the end of the day, it doesn't have a low-speed transfer case. So I'm wondering, why don't both of these companies actually do something with a low-range transfer case that actually takes on, like, the 4Runner?
Because I think that they're looking at the data behind it, right? So if you look at kind of, and you bring up a great point with that Sorento, if you look at the, when these manufacturers launched this crop of crossover, right? Even a Honda Passport, right? When they launched them back in the 90s and early 2000s, they built them thinking that the customer base cared about off-road performance. So if you look at like the Volkswagen Touareg had a low range, Porsche Cayenne had a low range, Mercedes ML had a low range, Kia Sorento had a low range, Honda Passport, right? The first generation was an Isuzu, that had a low range.
So the engineers were running the company.
Well, I think that they thought that's what consumers wanted, right? And then they got the mountain of data back that said, and I'm going to make this up, but 98.7% of consumers never touch dirt. Never ever touch dirt, right? So then they saw, well, why are we putting a low range in this vehicle? And the issue with low ranges, having a dedicated transfer case, is they are immensely costly for weight and fuel economy. So when, for example, the Cayenne lost its low range in the mid-2000s, it lost 500 pounds. 500 pounds. And these auto manufacturers...
I don't think it was all low range. There must have been other reasons.
But, yeah,
I mean, low range transfer case isn't 500 pounds.
But you have to reorganize the entire driveline of the vehicle around that low range. You have to.
Yeah.
And it makes them very heavy and also more expensive to produce. And the argument is, well, if the consumer isn't using it, why are we putting it in there, right?
Well, that's a fallacy that I think that most manufacturers understand, and that is it's not what people use it. It's what people want to use it or think they'll use it for. And so I don't believe that that is at all a valid argument because most people buy cars – and it's the same way with sports cars. It's the same with off-roaders. Not for what they're going to use it. Here's a good question. How many Corvette owners actually track their Corvette?
Zero.
And yet, that's why they buy it.
But
have you seen the ZR?
I know.
One, every single one of those reviews is on the track. And I'm betting 90% of the owners will never take it on the track.
Same thing with like a GT3 RS, right? I don't know how many of those are ending up on the track, but they're designed for it. So the solution is the Kia Sorento X-Pro or the Honda Passport Trail Sport, where they make them look more off-roady, but then you still get the benefits of good fuel economy and decent packaging and
then,
all that.
Then why isn't the 4Runner just look off-roady? And I think the reason the 4Runner sells so well and has such a loyal following is not because it looks all off-roady and not because it has, you know, ATs and has orange recovery hooks. We're looking at the Trail Sport, a fake hood scoop, you know, and a boxy design. It's because actually people take the dang things off-road and there is credibility there that sells more vehicles. And I think, especially today, people in this world are looking for two things, credibility and authenticity. And to me, when you make something look like an off-roader, but you don't give it the one thing that it needs to actually be an off-roader, you're cutting your rug out from underneath you.
I think that the Forerunner is a different thing, though. It doesn't. It sort of competes with the Trail Sport, but it definitely doesn't compete with the Sorento.
And look at the hottest cars, Tommy. And now we're talking about cars in America that sell for 100 or more thousand units, right? These are cars. Bronco, Wrangler. I think Wrangler sold like 200,000 units, right? And the lesson there, here's a lesson I think for the manufacturers is the Wrangler is a miserable car off-road. And yet...
On-road, sorry.
It's a miserable car on-road. And yet people are buying them, you know, not, at least they were, knocking down doors because, not because they're going to take them off-road, not because they're going to go to Moab, but because they liked what the car says about them. And the problem with the Trail Sport and having the kind of the let's call it pseudo off-roady looks without the actual, you know, as Nathan would say, off-road cojones, is that it says about you that you're not real, but that you're fake.
What sells better than Wrangler and Bronco combined?
RAV4.
And that has no off-road.
But that's a whole different segment.
But hang on.
That is not in that segment. That is not in that segment. That segment is... like Passport, Sorento.
So what sells better than Wrangler and Bronco? Highlander. And that's what this segment
is. Yes, Highlander. This is definitely
Highlander is a segment.
Yes.
And I would argue that the Sorento is not targeting the 4Runner, right? It's not, if they're not looking at a 4Runner buyer. The 4Runner buyer has been different from the Sorento buyer since 4Runner debuted in 1984, right? The 4Runner has always been a dedicated four-wheel drive vehicle. The Sorento is a family hauler first and foremost.
Not true. It came out with a low range.
But it was never very good off-road. I mean, it did have a low range, but we took that thing off-road. It was pretty bad, right? I mean, that was that era, like the Mercedes ML, right? That had a low range as well. But they were targeting the wrong buyers. So this is a category of vehicle where they're targeting the family. The 4Runner is targeting the adventurous. And I know there is some crossover there, but they're different concepts. They're different vehicles.
I'm just saying, especially with, you know, with the badging and the look, I mean, if they were really targeting, like you say, right, mm-hmm. the family hauler, then why don't you go, you don't see the Highlander going all off-roady.
Because they don't need to. They have the 4Runner.
Right, and these guys don't.
So you want them to come out with like an own dedicated platform, like a whole nother model line.
No, or if you're going to go down that road, make it actually give it, you know, you could build one with a low range and you could sell one without a low range. It's not that hard to have two products.
It's very hard to have two products like that because a low range indicates...
Tommy, they build cars that are two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, or rear-wheel drive now. Chevy has done that, right, with electric cars.
So
if you can make a car that's either front-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, or all-wheel drive, and you choose, why can't you add a transfer case? I think you're over-exaggerating how hard it is to add a low-range transfer case to a car.
So to have a typical four-wheel drive with the low range, mm-hmm. right, has a longitudinally mounted engine and a rear-biased four-wheel drive.
Touareg didn't have a longitudinally mounted engine.
It did.
No, it had several engines.
It did not. They were all longitudinally mounted. Every single Touareg had an engine that went forward and back. Yes, it was forward and back. The V10, forward and back.
The Wrangler doesn't have one.
Yes, it does. The Wrangler is longitudinal.
Right.
There's no transverse mounted four-wheel drives.
Right.
They're all longitudinal.
Okay.
Every crossover is transverse because it's a better...
Every crossover is transverse?
In this segment, every crossover is transverse.
I don't think every
RAV4, Highlander, Sorento, Sportage, CRV, Passport, Pilot, they're all transverse.
And the reason for that is...
It's packaging.
No, it's because they built a front-wheel drive version as well. That's why. Because it's not because of the low-range transfer case. It's because they build a front-wheel drive version.
But the reason they do a front-wheel drive version is because it's better packaging, right? You don't have to have... as much
right, but you're making it sound like the reason they're doing a longitudinal is because it, you know, it can't have a low speed transfer case. I'm saying the reason they do that is because it's front wheel drive.
So the solution then is so transverse mounted are better for packaging, right? And you can do a front wheel drive version, which is better than having a rear wheel drive version for most people. Would you agree?
No. I disagree with everything that you said. 100% I disagree with everything. And I'll tell you why.
Why?
First of all, we are living in a time... Here, let me take a huge step back, all right? I think manufacturers ignore what enthusiasts want at their own risk. And that's what they're doing right now. What they're doing is they're putting marketing and product planners ahead of what the consumer wants. And you can see that in all sorts of different ways. I'll give you like three good examples of that, mm-hmm. right? What enthusiasts want is also what the buying public now wants. Once upon a time, that may have not been true. First example, BMW just brought in for the first time ever the touring version of the M5.
Sure.
It's outselling the regular one like by 10 to 1.
Sure.
In fact, the RS6 Avant, right, mm-hmm. doesn't even come in a regular RS6. It only comes in the Avant, which is the station wagon. And mm-hmm. yet, the common thought among manufacturers is that Americans hate or do not want or have fallen out of love, however you want to say it, wagons. And yet, enthusiasts have always loved wagons, and BMW finally brings a wagon, and guess which one sells?
The wagon.
It's once again, they ignored the enthusiasts.
So
let's talk about stick shifts. All right? Manufacturers are doing away with stick shifts because of 100 different reasons, from it's cheaper, people don't want them. Yet I've heard all the reasons, and yet what you're seeing now in the classic car market world is people are retrofitting stick shifts into all kinds of cars, and those cars are more valuable because of it. And that, to me, should be a loud and clear message to manufacturers that people want engagement. They want the stuff that makes the car fun to drive. It's a reaction to kind of the soullessness of electric cars.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I think there's obvious areas where people are asking for that.
And I think this is also one of them. I think people want real. They want what's authentic. They don't want fake hood scoops. They want a real hood scoop. They don't want a car that looks like it can go off-road. They want a car that can go off-road.
I disagree. If that was the case, Forerunner would outsell RAV4.
No, RAV4 is its own thing,
Tommy. It's a small crossover.
No, that is just in the is in the sweet spot of vehicles.
You're right. Then Forerunner would outsell Highlander. Why does Forerunner not outsell
Highlander? I don't know what Highlander sells. I don't know.
Highlander sells huge numbers. And the reason
we don't just throw that out there.
Should we look it up?
Yes, please look it up. I would bet you that Forerunner sells more than Highlander.
2024, Highlander sells.
Maybe if you include Highlander and Grand Highlander, I don't know. But I bet you Forerunner outsells Highlander. I would say Forerunner is probably Toyota's second most popular car.
Good car, bad car. I don't think that's correct.
Okay, well, we'll look it up.
Okay.
Right. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
Yeah. Highlander. So they sold, let's see about how many Highlanders
sell. Let me finish my third example. I said, while you're looking up there, mm-hmm. I'll give you, right? You just said that people want front-wheel drive. I don't think so. I think people want rear-wheel drive. I think that is making a comeback because it is, as Clarkson has said so eloquently, it is more fun and more entertaining and more engaging to have the rear wheels push the car and have the front wheels steer the car. When you put both of those features into the front wheels, it all of a sudden becomes less fun. And now people out there, I think, are looking for authenticity, and I think are looking for cars that are fun to drive and are back to the basics. That's where I think the market is going. And I think that for the longest time, manufacturers have ignored, and I say people, I mean enthusiasts, have ignored us enthusiasts, and I think that they have hurt themselves in the process because they're ignoring what their customers want. All right, would you get the numbers? Still looking at it?
Yeah, they sell about 150,000 Highlanders every year and about 90 to 100,000 Forerunners.
Okay, you're right.
So they sell more Highlanders.
Now, is that combined Highlanders?
No, that's just Highlanders. Grand Highlander is its own thing.
Separate thing?
Yeah. Here we go. Grand Highlander. Look at Cole.
Thank you, Cole.
So you want to zoom in, Cole? I have no idea what I'm looking at. Thank you, buddy. 2024. Highlander sold 100,000, 71,000 Grand Highlanders and 92,000 Forerunners.
Yeah.
But Highlander's old, so that had a pretty bad year.
Well, so is Forerunner for that.
No, that's 2024. Oh, yeah, they're both old.
They're both old.
So they sell more Highlanders and Grand Highlanders than Forerunners.
But not uncombined.
It's about the same, right?
Yeah.
So 2023, though, look how many Highlanders they sold in 2023. That's a better comparison. 169,000 Highlanders in 2023.
Well, you're just saying it's a better comparison because it supports your argument.
No, they were both not due for redos. Right,
but the Forerunner also is much older than Highlander.
Look, they sell a lot of Forerunners. Yeah. But, Dad, you're conflating a couple things here.
Okay.
A lot of people have been asking for M5 Tourings. This is not a new thing, right? People have been asking for M5 Tourings since they started the M5 in the U.S., right? It's been every generation.
How long do you think before they bring the M3 Touring, now that they've figured
Very
out
Very soon, yeah. because that's another thing. People have been asking for manual transmissions in sports cars for years. I have not heard one person who said, geez, I wish this Sorento had a low range. There's no one is asking for that.
Sometimes you have to put your finger into the wind and see which way it's blowing, and then you have to understand that, you know, that there are these trends that are happening, and then there are these currents, and maybe, you know, everybody, if it was that easy, if you just listen to, you know, that this is a famous thing, of course, that Steve Jobs said, right? He said, customers don't know what they want until you give it to them. Mm-hmm. And that refers to the iPhone. So you could make that argument that people actually do want it, but no one is asking for it because the manufacturers haven't figured out that people actually want it.
So then why did they get rid of the low ranges on all those first-gen SUVs?
I'm
not trying to be snarky. It's a genuine question. If, in fact, that's what people wanted.
First of all, the problem with all those low-range SUVs is that even though they had the low-range SUV, the vehicle did not look like an active lifestyle vehicle. So you can look at the Mercedes, you can look at the Touareg. They all looked exactly alike. There was nothing that said when you had the double-locked Touareg that this was the off-road one. There was no packaging. Sure. There was no marketing. It just looked like every other one. And same thing with the Cayenne. And, in fact, the only one that actually looked like it was the Cayenne Trans-Siberia, mm-hmm. right? That actually had, and those things are now highly sought after and, much more valuable by like a factor of maybe 4 or 5 than the same year of a regular Cayenne. And that's because they didn't market them as off-roaders. They just marketed them as more expensive Touaregs or MLs or Cayennes.
Right. So, I mean, the problem I'm facing is I just don't think people are going to want to make that sacrifice. A Sorento buyer, right, is a family. If you went to them and said, you can sacrifice 4 mpg, but have a low range transfer case.
You won't sacrifice 4.
It's about 3 or 4. It's a big cut, Dad.
You won't sacrifice 4.
It's a big cut. It's a huge cut because it's a lot of weight and it's a lot of drivetrain lag. 3 or 4 mpg, would you go for a low range? And you might also lose some interior volume.
I don't think it's 3 or 4. I think it might be 1 or 2, Tommy. And I'm sure if I thought about it, I could come up with 2 similar cars, with one with a low range and the fuel economy be very similar.
So there are a couple cars that have a low range versus no low range. Can I say those?
Yes, of course.
So Grand Cherokee, you can get one with a high range, mm-hmm. you get one with a low range, okay. right? That's a good example of one, but that's also a longitudinal setup. And that fuel economy, unless you get the 4xe, I bet is worse than the Passport.
I don't know.
Another car, there's only been one car ever, crossover, mm-hmm. that I can think of, that's transverse with the low range and then as the option for no low range. Can you think of it?
No, what is it?
It's the Cherokee. The Jeep Cherokee had a low range, but the way they were able to engineer the Cherokee was crazy. They actually gave it 2 different low ranges. So they gave one low range in the front for the front axle, and then they had to do another one in the back for the rear axle, if I remember correctly. They were like 2 different setups.
So the reason I don't believe what you're saying is right, because I believe what you're saying would have been right 20 years ago when we had, you know, old technology, old engines. Now we have much more fuel efficient, much more clever engines. And more on top of that, a lot of the cars that now have, let's say, all-wheel drive versus two-wheel drive, you know, are powering the rear wheels with electric motors, which don't have that natural sacrifice in fuel economy. Mm. And that doesn't mean a low range, but they do have.
Sure.
Right? Like a good example of that are all the Toyotas.
Sure.
Right? They have and Lexuses where they have they have no drive shaft between right. the front and the back.
But they don't work off-road.
They're not, you know, your testing has proved that they're not very good off-road. Yeah. The other example I would point to, what's the best-selling vehicle in America?
RAV4.
No.
Okay, vehicle. F-150.
Exactly. A truck. It's a truck. Mm-hmm. And what do trucks do? They all go off-road. They all go off-road. It didn't used to be that way, but you'd be hard-pressed to find a two-wheel drive truck these days. Everybody wants a 4x4 when it comes to getting a pickup.
That's a really good example, actually. Mm-hmm. General Motors in their current generation Silverado did something that was kind of unheard of.
Which is?
Do you remember this?
No.
And I was talking to him about why they did this. In the Silverado, forever, if you got four-wheel drive, you automatically got 4-low.
Yeah.
The engineer said, we realized people weren't using 4-low.
Yeah.
So we got rid of it.
What happened?
Nothing. Nobody cared. Because, did you know this?
Oh, thank you. So it's a good example for your point, not for my
point. Yes, for my point.
I thought he was actually going to say something like, Dad, that's smart, but I was mistaken.
No, but because what Chevrolet did, and I think this is smart, they got rid of the four-wheel drive low in the standard Silverado four-wheel drives because people weren't using it. So why have that added complexity? Why have that added weight? Why have more stuff to go wrong? So what they do, and this is a pretty smart thing that GM does, is the standard Silverado four-wheel drive doesn't have a low range. You don't need it. They've got a button instead, which kind of helps you off-road. Then you get the Trail Boss or you get the ZR2.
Yeah, I wonder why there's like 14 versions of the off-road one from the Tremor.
They do, and that's great. And those people do get the low range, which yes. is I think is great.
Yeah.
But the standard people don't need it. Right? The standard.
What is this? The standard people. I think if you were to put two pickup trucks on the lot, mm-hmm. and one without low range or one with low range, either FX4 if it's a Ford, sure. or a Trail Boss if it's a Chevy, or you know, mm-hmm. a Rebel, if the people, the one that people want, and I think the one that sells more is always going to be the off-road one. I think you actually made the wrong
because
point.
It looks cooler.
Yes, that's fine,
but then that's the Sorento.
But it actually works. No, because it looks cooler and it works.
Well, we'll let the comments kind of go into right. it. I still disagree. I don't think that a Sorento needs a low range. I just think that it's not the right vehicle.
I'm not
for
saying
that.
It needs a low range. I'm just saying if you're going to go and build an off-road, or whether it's a Sorento X-Pro.
So I think they should do what Ford did, where you've got the Bronco Sport, which is the on-road one, and then build a dedicated off-roader.
Or if you're going to do a Passport, you know, Trail Sport, then actually build one that – and I think you'd be surprised how much people will actually buy that if you put both of them on sale. And, yes, there are a lot of reasons that people buy cars, and oftentimes it has nothing to do with whether they can go off-road or have a low or high range. But I think that is changing. I think it's no longer just like you walk in the dealership and it's like, hey, I need some basic transportation. And the salesman says, look what I got sitting here on the lot. I think people, because of the way now people buy cars, are becoming much more choosy and much more particular. And it's no longer just like, this is a pretty, you know, look at all the chrome here. And the person's like, great, I've got a chromey car.
And
I think that's gone.
For us enthusiasts watching this podcast, that's true.
Yeah.
But I think most people, they just want it to look cool and they want it to work in the snow. I really do.
Okay, I disagree, but that's fine.
I really do. And I think that if
once again, don't listen to the enthusiast
at
your own risk.
If the typical SUV RAV4 buyer wanted a low range, that car would have a low range. And that's the best-selling car, not truck. You're right. The F-150 sells better. The best-selling car in the U.S. So, if the CR-V buyer wanted a low range, it would have a low range.
Hey, Cole, you think one day he'll actually give me like a little bit of like credit for these things?
Cole knew it. Cole's not even part of the podcast.
Yeah, he is. He's always part of he's part of your Carish podcast. You bring him into it all the time.
So let's move on because I
By
just...
By the way, go to Carish if you want to listen to a really fun podcast.
No, yeah.
I want to keep going with these.
Okay.
So the other trend that I'm seeing, and I saw this with the Tiguan I drove, and we saw it with the RAV4, is that now we're seeing like, and this has been going on a while, but now I think it's becoming a real trend, where you're seeing like sportier versions of very popular midsize, in the most popular segment, midsize crossovers. And, you know, with the RAV4, we saw the introduction of the GR Sport, which is just that, not a all-out, you know, race car, not a track car, but something that's much sportier. Mm-hmm. And I think... we're seeing it with the Tiguan, where I drove the base Tiguan, by the way.
Uh-huh.
I know that there is a more powerful one coming, mm-hmm. I think, this summer, right?
Yep.
I think the base one has 201 horsepower, but there's a 268 horsepower one, mm-hmm. R-Line, coming. And I think that's becoming a thing in the crossover world. And I think that I applaud them, because out of all the ones that I drove, and I drove five cars, we can talk about the other two if you want, but the one that I enjoyed the most was the Tiguan, from just a driving experience. And the thing that it was really missing was a stick shift. I would have loved that car, because I got in that car and all the other cars were kind of doing this like mountain, a little bit of a mountain drive. It was very short. It was like 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. But there were a couple of, you know, nice turns. And that was the only car that I actually wanted to push. That was like the car that I got into and I'm like, oh, okay,
so
this car.
So you think the Tiguan would sell better with the manual?
I think it would, yeah.
They had a manual Tiguan.
I know.
And nobody bought it.
I know, but I'm saying that was the one that I was like, hey, this is really fun to drive. All the others were basic transportation, great, you know, take the kids to school, take me to work. But that one was the one where I felt like, all right, this thing has got some like performance chops.
So you want a manual Tiguan?
I did.
You think that would sell?
I don't know if it would sell. I know I want it. I'm not pushing for that, because I know...
I don't think anyone would buy a manual Tiguan. I mean, they had one, right?
Once again, times change.
Yeah. I think you're overestimating a little what percentage of people still buy manuals, though. I mean, it's what, 2% or something?
No, it's like 8%.
Is it 8%?
It's going up, yeah.
Okay, well.
But there are fewer manuals left in the world, and they've kind of, I think, bottomed out at like 8% of the market. Anyway, so I really did like the new Tiguan. I was glad that they actually went back and got like a real volume knob in the middle, which they had gotten rid of in their latest IP. Mm-hmm. It had four switches for the four windows, which was nice. Mm-hmm. Not like the ID Buzz that we had. What'd you think of it? You actually went on the program.
Yeah, they did a nice job. I think it's a nice update. It's It's got a really refined interior. I think that that's the best part about it. It feels kind of like a luxury car, but for less money. So and it's very close now, really related to the new Q5 as well. So I actually don't think that it's worth spending more money on the Q5 because the Volkswagen interior is just as nice.
Did you think it was a good upgrade, or did you think it was just an evolution?
Definitely an evolution. Yeah. I mean, I think that
I feel like you kind of came back disappointed in the car, and I actually liked it a lot.
I like the car. I think that it's, you know, the screen has got, it's all screen. There's no buttons, which I think is a little bit of a miss because
mine had a lot of buttons on the steering wheel.
The steering wheel has buttons, but like the climate control is all on the screen, right? There's I would really like to see that those become physical buttons, and I think that the car is a nice evolution. But for example, why is there no hybrid? Best selling segment in the U.S.
It's got
a
2 liter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a 2 liter four
cylinder. But there's no hybrid. Yeah. Right. There's no plug-in hybrid. You know, the RAV4 hybrid, a CRV hybrid are blowing up in popularity, and Tiguan doesn't offer hybrid in that car.
God, a long time ago, I went on the Jetta hybrid drive. Remember that car?
Yeah.
That never did really well.
Yeah, but
I don't know if the Germans are like. Do the Germans do a lot of hybrids? They kind of do them in the luxury world, like BMW has, Mercedes. But does Volkswagen do any hybrids? There's no Atlas hybrid.
Not currently. Yeah. They have done hybrids, but they need to give a more emphasis on that. And plug-in hybrids too are also very popular now.
I feel like it's not in the beer. In Germany, the hybrid world, it just doesn't resonate. I think they do them because they have to do them because, like, especially in the luxury world, you know, there's a lot of competition in that. But I don't think in Volkswagen doesn't have. What other German car company does Škoda have a hybrid?
I mean, it's Volkswagen Group. I don't know.
Yeah.
But BMW has hybrids. Mercedes has a lot of hybrids.
Yeah. In the luxury segment, they do. Hey, Cole, what other car do we drive? I'm forgetting some.
Charger.
Oh, yeah. So I finally drove the 4-door Charger.
Okay.
My God, does that thing have huge.
Where'd you find the 4-door?
They had it there. It was a 2026.
Very cool.
Yeah, you got to drive it. I had never driven that.
No one, I don't think anyone in my press drive drove the 4-door.
No, but you drove the 2-door.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We could talk about this for years and years. I think that Cole said this because I was trying to come up with a good analogy. He said it's like trying to sell fish hooks to fish.
Sure.
You know? Yeah. I don't know how they're going to sell these cars without sticking a Hemi. And they might stick a Hemi in it because they now, yesterday, of course, they announced that they're putting the Hemi back in the Ram 1500, which means that maybe it's not that long before they stick the Ram. I'm sorry, before they stick the Hemi in the Charger. It's a really complicated car to love.
Yeah, I think that it's probably the most hated car for sale right now. And I do agree with you that selling an electric car to people that historically have hated electric cars was not the right move. But there's still a lot I liked about the car. I mean, I think the design's phenomenal.
Yeah, I think Ralph Gilles killed it. I mean, if you look at this thing, this is a beautiful addition to the muscle car world.
Case and I saw a bunch of these when we were in Michigan this week, and they're really interesting to see them on the road. I think it's a great design. It just has the wrong powertrain. The design's there, interior's really good. It holds a ton of stuff. The car's huge. And with the Hellcat engine, they would be selling these things left and right, and it would be a huge seller. But with the electric powertrain, it's just not appealing to people.
So with Tim Kaniskas back in, he's in charge of Ram, but back at the office, how long? I mean, they're still building the Hellcat Durango. So that engine is still in production, right?
I mean,
think it's the fifth year now for the one-year-only Durango Hellcat. How long could it take for them to snap, install a Hellcat into this?
They fast-tracked all the other ones. They fast-tracked the Ram. They fast-tracked the inline six for this car.
I don't think that the Hurricane's going to do it.
So I think give it 8 months and we'll have announcement that the V8 is in the Charger. Yeah, that's almost for sure in my mind going to be coming down the road.
There are a couple things, you know, I love the design. Did you see the size of those tires? They're like 235. I forgot what they were, but they're enormous.
They're way bigger than 235.
Are they maybe 335?
They're huge, yeah.
Maybe it was 335, yeah.
They're really big.
But what I didn't like was the shifter.
Pistol grip.
Yeah, but it was connected to nothing.
Well, that's every car now.
It felt like a video game, right? There was no resistance. There was no sense of like, this is moving any mechanical parts.
Sure, okay.
All I'm doing is moving, you know, a piece of plastic back and forth. But surprisingly, the interior space in the rear seat was also enormous. And I think what this is kind of bringing back is the big American sedan.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, it's not a sedan. It's kind of a hatchback. Mm-hmm. But what other big American sedans are left? There's nothing.
I mean, I hope it does.
There's no four-door sedan. There's nothing.
Yeah, this is it. I think that this car could be immensely successful. They launched it with the wrong powertrain, and I hope that by putting a V8 in it, we're going to...
Yeah, but 5 years ago when this was designed, right? Because mm-hmm. that's what we're looking at. It was the right powertrain. It's just that they had incredibly bad timing.
It was the wrong powertrain then, too.
You think? I mean, everybody was like, look at Tesla. They're killing it. It's the most valuable stock, right? Their stock is worth more than every other car company combined.
They have to look at the people buying these cars.
The Model Y became the best-selling car in the world.
So build an electric crossover, right? That's what they should have done. But you can't build an electric muscle car. I think that even I could have seen that. All of the Charger people and Challenger people that go online and complain about Teslas, what were they thinking?
I think hindsight's easy because we're now in an era where, you know, electric cars are so hated. But back then, the governments were saying you need to build them. There was huge incentives.
Yeah, just governmental pressure.
There was huge incentives, right? And they were tasked with something that I think would be fun for an engineer. How do you make a muscle car electric?
But what was it, 5 years ago or 6 years ago when they debuted the concept? And the negative reaction was so enormous. It was so profound against
I'll give you
that
yeah,
car.
Yeah.
That should have been an indication, like, we came out with this concept with this fratsonic sound that people think sounds like video games. Why are we still doing this?
Yeah, but once that train leaves a station in a big corporation, it's hard, you know, to pull it off the tracks.
Sure, right. But, I mean, Scout did it. Scout, that initial plan for the Scout was to be all electric. And they saw people's shifting points toward electrification. And I was talking to them, and they said they decided close to last minute to put that range extender in the Scout. And that's going to save that vehicle.
And then the other thing you're looking at this from a very American point of view, remember at that point when this was designed, Stellantis was owned by a European company. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans are moving full force along with the Japanese.
100%.
Along with the Chinese, along with, you know, many other places for full electrification. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, you know, it's easy to say, well, this was not going to ever work in America. But from a European point of view, that's a much harder decision to make.
I agree. And if this was a global car, I would understand it, right?
But it's a global car company.
It's a global car company, yeah. But this is the problem when American brands are owned by European companies.
I agree 100%.
They
yeah.
just don't we'll understand what Americans want or what Americans like, right? And I don't think that this was a case of that, right? They saw that, you know, okay, we got these mandates coming in Europe. It's where the world's going. But the world wasn't going there, right? That was a false...
Well, America wasn't going there. The world's going there.
Yeah, but America definitely wasn't. So, look, I think
do you think America will eventually go there? Or you think because of the Trump administration and because of what's happening with Tesla, we're taking a huge step back in electrification here?
I mean, I think long term, yeah, 100 years from now, there's a good chance that the majority of cars will be electric. But I think in my lifetime, I don't know if we're going to cross the 50% margin.
I mean, look, nobody has, in my mind, has yet built an electric car that's affordable and engaging. Apparently, the Renault 5 is that car. I don't know. I'm just reading the European reviews of it. But nobody in America, at least not one for sale, has built an engaging electric car. That doesn't mean it can't be done. Maybe Renault has done it. And so I don't know if you could actually create that car and sell it here. If it would do well, I just don't know how large of a percentage of the company is hell bent against electric cars, and how large a percentage of the country actually is on board with electric cars. I just don't know.
Well, I'll give you an example, anecdotal, and this was really surprising to me. I agree with you that I think for most people it's a better technology. Like, I love daily driving an electric car.
I think for commuting, especially just on a daily basis, it's just so much easier.
Yeah, and there's no maintenance, there's no going to a gas station. If you can fill it up at home, it's great. But then three people in my life all switched to electric,
yeah.
And I thought they were going to love it, and they like it. But they're not, like, totally in love with it.
Okay, tell me the experience.
First of all, your wife, my mom.
Yeah.
I was talking about her car. I'm like, do you love it? And she's like, yeah, it's okay. I'm like, would you go back to gas? She's like, absolutely.
She has an iX, BMW.
Yep. Morgan, my wife.
Yeah.
Like, do you like it? She's like, yeah, I like commuting in it. Would you ever go back to gas? She's like, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And then Mary, same thing. She's like, you like the EV? Yeah, it's great.
She has a
Would you go back Leaf. To gas? Oh, for sure. So I thought that once people experience it, it would be kind of a monumental shift. Like, there's no maintenance. I never have to go to the gas station. I can charge it up at home for pennies on the dollar. But people like what they like. And I kind of think that it's going to be a really long transition, much longer than a lot of us were expecting.
Well, I think, I mean, the other player in here that everybody somehow seems to fail to mention, and especially in America, is Mother Nature.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you know, we all like to pretend that that Mother Nature doesn't exist, and that we can control Mother Nature, and that what we're doing with the Earth right now is inconsequential in terms of what we're driving. I'm not sure that's true. A lot of people believe that all that is BS, but what you know we'll see in the next 10 years will determine, of course, how and which way the technology gets shifted.
I mean, I think all three of those people, and I've talked about this, would be happiest with the plug-in hybrid. And I think that's going to be the future.
And I get that. But once again, Mother Nature has a lot to say about it.
But plug-in hybrids, if you look...
You could be very happy with the plug-in hybrid, but if your house burns down, then all of a sudden your point of view may change. And we've almost had our house burned down twice now.
But the fact about plug-in hybrids, and you said better than me than I do, is once people start plugging them in, they never use gas. So the result is the same.
I thought it was the opposite. I've heard a lot of people who...
It depends. If people don't have a place to plug them in, they never plug them in.
Yeah.
But most people, if they have a place to plug them in, they will use exclusively electricity, which I think is a great thing. And then you've just got an EV. You're still getting the environmental savings, but then you have the security of having a gasoline for long trips.
Yeah, but you still have all of the maintenance with a...
Not really. I mean, if you're not using the engine...
You still have to maintain it.
I mean, yeah,
the car still ages when it sleeps.
Okay, once every 2 years you bring it in for an oil change, right? But that's not... Like, I have to do an oil change on my Land Rover every 4 months these days because she's been driving it a lot.
I say that because we've had direct experience with that. We bought that i3, which is a range extender, right? So it's got this little tiny engine, 600cc engine, which isn't very complicated and which doesn't need to be used a lot because that's basically an EV that has an emergency backup engine.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought the thing, and it only had like 20,000 miles on it. And the first thing I had to do was I had to go to the BMW dealership and fix the, I think it was a charcoal filter in the gas tank.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like $1,200.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's necessarily true that you're not going to have the same maintenance cost. You have two powertrains.
It's going to be less though, Dad.
I mean, potentially you have two power. You have a motor and
sure. But if you're only using the gas engine once a month versus every day.
Like I said, cars still age when they sleep.
Yeah, but not to that extent. You're not putting that mechanical wear on the engine, Dad.
And gas goes bad.
Sure, which is why the engines have to run. But you have to admit, it's got to be less maintenance.
Once again, I think you're ignoring my biggest point, and that is that's great that you have a plug-in hybrid, but when your house burns down, maybe you might change your mind on whether you feel like Mother Nature has a say in this or not.
I don't think people look at it like that.
Probably not, but maybe they will.
And if your house burns down and you don't have a charge in your car, at least with a gasoline engine, you can get out of that situation.
I wonder how people are looking at it in California.
I don't think people have changed their views very much, Dad. That's my opinion on that.
Okay, maybe you're right, but maybe at some point that realization does seep in. I don't know.
I don't think people
are we frogs or we just sit there and if we slowly turn up the
I don't think people connect the dots
before
Dad.
We jump out of the pot.
I don't think that's the situation. And I also think that people know that there's a lot more that goes into environmental savings than just cars, right? There's a lot of other industries that are polluting to a large extent other than just cars.
Like I say, I think Mother Nature has the final say in all of this. But we'll leave that. And let's talk about the McLaren, which is a car that I didn't drive. So they had it there, the Artura.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to drive it because we had already had it at the office. And it is plug-in hybrid supercar.
Mm-hmm.
It's purple. Tell me about it.
Well, I think that this is an interesting point. The hybrid system in the Artura is not for environmental savings. It's to make the car a better performer. And this is a really interesting setup. So this is a twin turbo 3-liter V6 with the plug-in hybrid system. And the total horsepower was 690 horsepower, which is unbelievable. And what was cool about this is I really liked this integration because the electric system felt like it made the car better instead of making it boring, which is often the case with many hybrids. So what you end up with is still this visceral raw roar of this V6, but then the hybrid system gives you that instantaneous EV launch when you go and hit the accelerator. It means that when the car shifts, you never get any lapse in acceleration. You get a constant acceleration curve. So it kind of elevated the experience rather than retract for it, which I think is the case with some other plug-in hybrids. And look, I know that you can make the argument that maybe it would be better with the V8 and no hybrid system, which I think is potentially true. But I really
they build that car.
Yeah, well, they do. Yeah, for sure. The higher end McLarens. But as a whole, I was very impressed with how this car operated as a hybrid. And it was so monstrously fast. I mean, we got a 10-second quarter mile at a mile above sea level on an unprepped surface, a 3.30 to 60, which was beyond what I would have expected at a mile above sea level on an unprepped surface. And two-wheel drive, what this car can do with two-wheel drive is unbelievable.
Last year, I flew up to Anchorage and bought an i8 and drove it back down the Alaska Highway, which was interesting. Anybody can drive a Jeep down the Alaska Highway. Me and Cole had the fun experience of driving the i8, which was fun. And then we got to Calgary, and then we decided to drive all the way back from Calgary to Boulder, which is like 1,300 miles. Is that right, Cole? It was like that. Anyway, we left crazy early, and we got here at like 2 in the morning, and we're driving down. It's a Friday night past Fort Collins on I-25. In this i8, and we're both tired as all hell because we've been driving now 3 days straight for over 3,000 miles. And this guy pulls up to me in an M5, and we're doing like 60. And he's like, "Hey, you want a race?" You could tell he's like egging me on to race. And that gave me the idea that it might be kind of fun to do that in a controlled environment to see how quick cars are from 60 to 100. Basically, what people do kind of on street racing, we try to do as kind of interesting and fun, safe experiment on a controlled, closed road. And so you took the Artura, and you did that against the i8 and against our C8. Tell me about that. How did that go? And that video will be up this weekend. So if you're interested in that race, head on over to LTFL.
Well, really the interesting one is that this was more of like a budget performance race between the Corvette and the i8.
Yeah.
And then we threw the Artura in just to show the difference between a quick car and an insanely quick car. And the i3 and the C8, the standard C8 Z51 Corvette were neck and neck. And at sea level, it'd be different, but at a mile above sea level, they ran pretty much
60 to 100 miles per hour.
Pretty much exactly the same. Pretty much exactly the same quarter mile time. Unbelievably close. And then the McLaren was like in another league.
Like that.
Yeah. Like the C8 wasn't even in the competition. And it, what would be really interesting would be to get a Z06 C8 or a ZR1 C8 and put it up against the Artura.
I asked Jim if we could get I'd like to get a ZR1 for the channel. So we asked Jim if they could help us with an allocation. We're not asking for any discounts. I have not heard back from him.
Yeah,
let me know in the comments if you want us getting a ZR1.
Probably a no.
That's going to be a no, considering we weren't invited on the launch down in COTA.
Yeah.
But maybe, I don't know. I'm out of all the new cars, that's the one that's got me the most excited about. You talk about, you know, something that is classic, 1,068 horsepower rear wheel drive. Wow.
Yeah.
That is
amazing.
That is amazing. I don't know how you keep those rear wheels from, you know, not tearing off the car with that much power.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. But the McLaren was incredible. It was a really interesting car. It's $360,000. So we're comparing a $60,000 used Corvette and a $50,000 used i8. So obviously it should be faster, but the rate at which that car puts on speed, it's too much for the road. Like, there's no way you can use that on a road situation. But on a track situation like we did, it was amazing.
I was sitting there filming with Cole when one of the other journalists drove it by, and it actually sounds really good for a six-cylinder.
Yeah,
I would
it's
have
okay.
known it was a six
yeah,
by
it's
just hearing
good.
It. Yeah, I think they did a really good job with that. Cole, how much time are we at? Where are we at?
1 hour.
Okay, so let's finish up now. You actually got to live my childhood because you went to Detroit, and you got to drive cars that were, I'm using air quotes here, popular when I was a kid, and that is
the 1924 Chrysler.
Yeah, no, not the Airflow. No, you got to go to program. Where you got to drive classic Chryslers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the Airflow. I'm not talking. Actually, you were one of like a few hundred people that actually got to ride in a turbine car.
Yeah, it was
tell
very
me about
cool.
that. How cool is that?
Yeah, they have two of them, and they pulled one out of the collection for us to cruise around in. And I would have loved to have driven it, but after kind of learning about how rare they are, I probably wouldn't want to drive it. But one of nine Chrysler turbine cars still remaining.
I think Jay Leno has one.
Mm-hmm, Jay Leno has one.
Is it loud? Is it hot? Is it? Is it the Jetsons?
Is that reference too old? It's pretty interesting. I mean, it kind of feels like a very slow EV. So
it's got a helicopter turbine, right?
Or it's not a helicopter turbine. It's its own custom turbine for that car.
Which is what helicopters use.
Yeah, or like the M1 Abrams is kind of what that turbine program evolved into.
And it runs on anything.
Yeah, it runs on unleaded. It runs on diesel, kerosene, perfume. They ran one on tequila. Anything that's flammable. So really interesting program, right? They built 55 of these cars. They gave them to 200 families for a three-month period to test the feasibility of it. And what amazing thing is, like, it looks like a concept car, but it functions like a real car. Like, it's got everything you need in a car. It's got seat belts and a heater, and it's got a radio, and it's got an automatic transmission.
But they gave them to or sold them to?
No, they lent them to.
Okay, so it was like the EV1.
Yes, yeah, sort of. Sort of like that. Yeah, 200 families had access to the car for 3 months, and they put over 1 million miles on them over the 55 cars. And then at the end of the program, they realized that – I asked them why they didn't sell the cars, right? First of all, these were essentially hand-built cars, right? You can't have prototypes cruising around in case for liability, one of the reasons.
But in the 50s, you probably could have.
63 maybe.
Maybe,
but
yeah.
Two, the other reason too is these cars – this wasn't a mental – more than an engineering feat, it was a marketing masterpiece because they got these cars in front of – every single newspaper and news organization in the country. And then Chrysler was synonymous with turbine cars, even though the other three had.
I mean, you're right. I mean, think about an equivalent of that today.
Well, like
– if you got a car to be like – remember how Musk was talking about having actual jets on a car?
Yeah.
Imagine if you had a real like rocket engine.
Sure.
Right. In a car and you got to drive a real rocket engine car. How cool would that be?
But they didn't want these cars to end up then after the program sitting on used car lots with the Hemi V8 in them, right? They didn't want the reputation of this car tarnished.
Yeah.
So what they did is they went out and to museums around the country and they said, do you want these cars? Like, we'll let you have these cars. And only 6 museums said they wanted one.
Wow.
So nobody
I would start a museum just for that.
And they were pretty hurt by that apparently because no museum wanted them because at the time in the late 60s, they were just like a used car. Like, ah, what are we going to do with this thing? Wow. So then they ended up burning
and crushing
what 46 of them, I think.
Oh gosh.
But yeah, the car was really cool. It really felt like a very slow EV.
Oh my gosh, that's so sad, Tommy. I mean, first of all, it's sad that these things were crushed because they were so ahead of their time, or maybe like a dead end in terms of their offshoot, but still an engineering masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And now I think about Chrysler and what they did back then, and now they have one car that they're selling.
Yeah.
And it's a minivan, which is fine. But, I mean, talk about, like, where has the innovation gone?
Yeah, I agree.
So it's really sad. But let's lighten it up a little bit before we end this. You also got to drive now the car I was talking about from my era, the LeBaron.
Yeah, so they had – I got to drive Lee Iacocca's personal LeBaron Town and Country.
God.
1986 Chrysler LeBaron. It's actually the best car I drove that whole day.
What was the other one you drove?
They had a bunch of them, so we could drive 1958 Chrysler 300D.
Yeah.
That's definitely not it, Cole. Look up 1986 LeBaron.
That's a little older, I think. It's like 70s.
They had a Chrysler 300D that we could drive, which was like one of the letter cars.
You hated that car, you said.
C300, Chrysler C300, which is also a letter car. Legendary vehicles. Yeah. They had a Cordoba 76.
How was a Cordoba?
It was terrible.
Did it have Corinthian leather?
No, it did not. It had vinyl. But the 86, it's that convertible one, Cole.
The red one.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that.
This was actually...
Oh, God.
It was the best driving car there.
When these things roam the planet, I just thought to myself...
But look,
American cars will never succeed in the world, and they haven't because of this. The legacy of this is still hurting American cars. The
legacy of that is it saved Chrysler.
That, I think, was a K car.
Yeah, saved Chrysler.
Not that one.
That car saved Chrysler.
The K car, not the convertible.
Not the convertible Woody, but the K car as a whole... That was a car that saved Chrysler. Because
they sold like 14 of those.
The 501 in 1986.
Okay, I told you, yeah.
The convertible LeBaron was not the car. But the K car as a whole, I was shocked at how well it drove. And part of it is
I drove a K car my first job, a station wagon.
Yeah, this car had 2,700 miles on it, so it was basically brand new.
Did it have velour?
No, it had leather. This was a Mark Cross.
Mine had velour.
Mark Cross.
Red velour.
Genuinely, I was ready to hate on this car. Turbocharged engine. Really pretty decent power.
Can you look up Aries K, please?
Yeah.
That's what I drove. Aries K wagon.
A-R-I-E-S. Turbocharged engine. Automatic transmission. Really comfortable seats. Steering was great compared to the 50s cars we were driving.
That was the first car I had at the TV reporter.
I'm not saying it's a magnificent car.
It had Action News across. It was white. It had Action News across the side with a big eye, you know, the big CBS eye.
Yeah.
That was the TV car. Look at that thing. Oh, my God.
It's fine.
It's horrible. It was horrible.
It's a car. It was meant to be used as transportation.
I think we had like a fleet of like I was in Rockville, Illinois, and I want to say we had a fleet of either four or five of them.
Uh-huh.
At any given time, at least one was in the shop.
Sure.
At any given time.
But it was the '80s. Everything was broken in the '80s. Seriously, though.
Hey, let me see the one. What was the big one that you hated? The New Yorker.
Hang on. I want to look up one number here. They sold, how many K cars do you think they sold?
They sold hundreds of thousands.
2 million.
Yeah, I know. And there's not one roaming the street left.
The one I drove. Okay. 2,000 miles on Lee Iacocca's personal.
What was the giant Chrysler you drove?
It's a Cordoba.
Can you look up a Cordoba, please?
It's 76 Cordoba.
A Cordoba. That was Ricardo Montalban.
Yes.
From Fantasy Island.
That was his Corinthian leather.
Oh, my God. Look at that's not bad.
It was horrible. It was a terrible car.
That's not bad. It looks a little bit like a Grand Prix. Remember the Pontiac Grand Prix?
Yes. Also a terrible car.
It's got that kind of vibe going on.
So I drove this car.
Yeah.
And it handled terribly. The steering had no feel. I mean, it was just... The build quality was horrible.
Look at all that chrome.
Yeah, but you can kind of see why Detroit barely survived the malaise era. But I hate to say it, you drive that car back-to-back to that LeBaron convertible.
Yeah.
The LeBaron had power. It had brakes that worked.
Sure.
The steering was good. It didn't feel like it was made out of wet noodles.
It actually worked.
Yeah. So as much as we hate the K car... It was a lot better
what
than
was, the Cordoba. What was the other one, the New Yorker you drove?
No, they had a 500D.
Oh, can you look up a 500D?
300D, sorry. Chrysler. It's a 1958 Chrysler 300D.
This is before my time.
This was one of my dream cars. I've always wanted to drive one. No, God, not the Mercedes. Look up Chrysler. It's the blue one, Cole, or the white one.
You're there.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, it's one of those. Uh-huh. The big mouth thing with
the
giant fins.
Yeah, huge fins.
And you drove this, and how was this?
It was worse than the Cordoba.
Why?
I was so unbelievably... This was one of my dream cars as a kid. Yeah. The huge fins. And
that's a good-looking car.
392 cubic inch V8.
Looks like it's about to... Whatever car it's behind looks like it's going to gobble it up.
Yeah. It had that forward look design. Yeah. And I couldn't tell you how excited I was to drive this car.
Oh, look at those white walls. Oh, my gosh.
And not a single part of the car was bolted to any other part of the car with anything but a little bit of tinfoil. I mean, the car was perfectly restored, but it drove so... Badly.
Did it wander down the road where you had to correct
the steering? Was horrible, and the brakes were terrible, and the suspension was terrible. I mean, and I know it's an old car, and I love old cars, and I drive old cars every day, but it was a good reminder just how objectively bad American cars were in the 50s. But the design is stunning. I mean, it's got so much road presence in it. Oh, it was just such a good-looking car, and I was so bummed driving it because I've always wanted to own one of those cars, and it was did not live up to the dream.
I mean, the tail fins are kind of medium for the tail fin era, right?
Look at the red one. They're pretty huge.
Oh, from the
this
back.
This is the Virgil Exner era.
Go farther down where you see it from the back. Yeah. Those are pretty big.
Really amazing piece of design, and it was super influential car, right?
Those look like wings almost, like folded in wings.
392 cubic inch firepower Hemi V8.
And look at that glass, the curved glass. How cool is
that? Oh, incredible. Yeah, car was such a masterpiece of design.
If you break that, how do you even replace that glass?
Not easily. Yeah. I wouldn't want to break it. That was a curved windshield era of Chrysler.
All right, so out of all the cars you drove at this Chrysler, you were at Belle Isle. What was your favorite?
The LeBaron. I'm telling you, the LeBaron.
And this is your least favorite?
Yes, it was my least favorite. The LeBaron after driving this pile. I was just so disappointed. This car was such a stunner. And the steering is worse than our 1927 Model T. But the LeBaron, I was ready to hate on and make jokes about, and it actually drove fine. And then this car, which I was ready to put on a pedestal in my life forever, drove like a cabbage cart.
So would you, if somebody offered you one, would you buy one or would you?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, all right. So you still want it.
Yeah.
If you had the choice between the LeBaron and this
300D.
One. Okay, you'd buy the 300 still.
But
all right.
We're also comparing a car worth $60,000 to a car worth $600. So it's...
Well, I mean, you pay them $600 to take it off their hands.
Yeah, it's a tough comparison.
Well, guys, thank you for listening. A couple of things. I want to thank our Patreons, right?
Uh-huh. Patrons?
I hate that word.
Patrons?
Patrons, Patreon. The whole thing is just goofy. They could have just came up with something so much easier to pronounce.
Well, they keep the podcast going.
They do, but we appreciate you guys. If you want to see the very first TFL 60 to 100 MPH race, check out alltfl.com. What are we up to next week, Tommy? We're going to Montana, my man.
Yeah, we're going to go drive some Bentleys in Montana.
Yeah, the full line of Bentleys. I'm so excited.
That should be pretty cool.
I had to go buy new pants and a new suit.
There you go.
So I look good on the Bentley program. Aren't you going somewhere else, or is that it?
Nope, that's it for next week.
And yep. Then we've been doing this interesting thing. If you've noticed, let me know if you like it. We've been trying to promote upcoming videos and some of our other videos. So at the end of our videos, we're putting a little Easter egg, a little quick trailer for the upcoming video. So if you want to see the McLaren race, it's published today, at least a trailer for it at the end of the McLaren first drive.
Look, yep. So head over to altfl.com and you'll find them all there.
And thank you for listening and thank you for watching. Thank you for doing this with me, Tommy.
Yep, we'll see you next time.
Ciao.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com, Upwork.com.